Good morning, everybody. Good to see you all here this morning. Good to have Rhonda with us and Caleb out of the hospital. Talking about great accommodations. It's probably not that, right?
Not great food.
Not great food, huh? Yes, indeed. Well,
I saw that he's a certificate-wielding person now.
Is that right? Well, congratulations.
He got out of
the traffic
box.
It's a really expensive traffic box.
Does that mean you didn't
carpet
yet?
No.
They're okay. Just step in the process.
So if you have an aircraft that needs, you got a problem, you know, just call Caleb and come right over now.
Okay. Very good. Well, that's great. Well, if you need a furnace that needs fixed, I have a little more experience in that now. Well, let me tell you the extent of my knowledge, and you'll decide how much you need me. I thought my pressure switch was bad, and I replaced it. It still didn't work, so that's not much in the way of success. And I got to thinking, well, okay, there's probably an obstruction in my intake up on the roof. And I went up there and stuck my hand up in it, and yeah, there's something there. And I pulled my hand back out, and wasps started falling out. And fortunately, it was a cool morning. They couldn't fly. But they had built a nest on that intake and restricted the airflow so that it wouldn't adequately pull air. And so you see, I don't have extensive knowledge, but if you have wasp problems, I can help you with that.
On a cool morning.
That's right. Yeah, that would. I mean, before I got down, I had maybe 18 or 20 of them on the roof there. So if that would have been a warm morning, I might have
kind of hard to get away very far.
I might have come down off the roof like Dan did this week, or I came down off the ladder in a hurry. Watch that first step. Anyway. Let's see, how can we make a transition into Isaiah here? it's going to be maybe a little abrupt. But anyway.
We're prophesying slightly in the morning.
Uh-huh.
Icy, frosty rafters, who was going to go through the ceiling at Thomas's.
Okay.
It happened, so fortunately our prophecy was awesome.
Okay. So that gets us to prophecy. That's helpful. Thank you, Dan. Good. So here at the end of chapter 44, we have truly an astounding prophecy by Isaiah. Now, it's not quite as impressive to us many, many years later because it's all ancient history. But the fact that it occurred and the fact that he knew the details down to the name of the coming ruler who would liberate the Jews is amazing. And just to show you how unfair it is that to him that this was done so long ago, you know, whenever you prophesy something and it comes to pass, and you prophesied it before it came to pass, which is the whole idea of prophecy, by the way. It gives you great credibility, right? But whenever you live so long ago that there's no way to prove when you actually wrote it, because it wasn't chiseled in stone and dated, then people argue after the fact about whether you actually did write it before it happened. Because after all, it was so accurate. How could he possibly know ahead? That's not even possible, right? So there you go. But what an unfair thing. Of course, for Isaiah to have not, or whoever wrote Isaiah, to have not recorded these things until after the fact would make them the ultimate fraud and hypocrite, because the whole point of much of the argumentation in these chapters is that God is saying, I'm telling you what's going to happen before it happens. Who else can do that? Who else can tell you what's coming? And imagine, I mean, how cynical could a writer be to pretend to be doing that after things had already occurred? That's strange, the limits of credibility in my mind. Anyway, these are beautiful passages here that show God in the process of redeeming his people, of bringing them in spite of their sin, in spite of their failure, bringing them to be the instrument in his hands by which he wanted to save the world. And so I'm going to back up just a few verses here from where we were ending last week and start with verse 21 of 44. It's written, "Remember these, O Jacob and Israel, for thou art my servant. I have formed thee. Thou art my servant, O Israel. Thou shalt not be forgotten of me. I have blotted out as a thick cloud thy transgressions, and as a cloud." And of course, actually, that's a different word. It makes it redundant in the English to do that. So in the first case, darkness, cloud. In the second case, it still means a cloud, but it's a different word. And it would be, I think some translators say a mist. And I don't know if it's just a matter of age or what, but the whole matter of vision is such a critical thing in navigating the world, especially when you're driving on the road in a high rate of speed. And I've been doing some log hauling early in the morning, and there are certain circumstances that really, really just mess with your vision. Certainly fog is one of them, but intense differences of light and dark can do the same thing. If you're driving into the sun and it's really bright, and you go into there's a place over just before you get to Xenia, well, going through the bottoms there, Skillet Fork Bottoms, there's a pretty sharp curve, and the tree cover is very dense. And so in the morning, you're squinting to see through the sun, and all of a sudden, there's shadow. And it's like the road disappears. It's like, what do we do now? Well, you try to keep the same trajectory here for a little bit and slow down. Watch for that white line. But it brings to mind somewhat the images here that Isaiah is using. Things, if you can't see them, they don't exist in your mind. There's no guide to respond to that reality if you can't see it. And so God says here that he has blotted out the transgressions of his people. Yes.
The thing too, if we don't see them, they might still exist. If God doesn't see them, then they don't exist.
Yes, indeed. They won't be back to haunt us, will they?
If we're haunted by them, it's our own doing. It's not because they're really there to. Yeah.
But what an offer when you think about it. As human beings, we remember all too well those things that we would like to forget. And come election cycle, we find that our enemies remember all too well sometimes things which maybe didn't even happen, but which are accusations that they may make stick. So what a contrast in that kind of activity and God saying, I have redeemed you and I have blotted out your transgressions. There is nothing like the cleanness of the feeling of being forgiven, of being able to leave behind the past, which we would so love to forget, so love to change, so love to erase. And God of all people, who has the ultimate memory in character, for him to say, I just blot them out. Make them as though they don't exist. They don't for him. That's a level of forgiveness that's just really hard to wrap your brain around. I mean, I know we've been taught it from a very young age, so it's like we sort of don't pay attention to how big it is, but that's a big deal. It really is. And it speaks to the very character of God, his desire for a restored relationship. Because I don't know if you've ever had an interaction with somebody that didn't go well, and you sort of dread seeing them after that, you know, especially if you're ashamed of your conduct. And every time that you see them, it's like, oh, I'd like to forget that. I'd like to forget that person, maybe, because I don't want to recall that encounter. And so God, in his desire to fully restore relationship with us, assures us that those things are gone, as far as I'm concerned. And that, of course, lays a bridge for us to him. Because if we're not faced every time with the memory of those things and worried about what he's thinking about us, you know, I know what you did. I know about the skeletons in your closet. If we know he's not doing that, that gives us a basis to trust him. And to place ourselves back in the position he wants us as his servant, as his child. He says, I have redeemed thee.
It's so amazing how it works that once we have acknowledged and trusted him in that, that he enables us to do that for others. And so it can continue between each other.
Absolutely. Although it takes a good deal of effort on our part to forget those things, to blot those things out of our minds. Whether they're things that we have done or whether they're things that others have done to us.
Right. I'm not saying that we would be able to totally forget.
Right.
Yeah, I agree with that. But you can let it go and just not even really feel it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Especially if it sometimes takes time.
But it's part of our imitation of God. It's part of our walking in his image that inspires us to do that, rather than to respond to the natural tendency to hold on to things. You know, I remember what you did to me. I'm not going to forget. And of course, we always add the disclaimer, well, there are some people that you better remember what they did to you because they haven't repented. They haven't changed the way they are or the way they're thinking. But we want to. We want to forgive them. That's the thing. We don't want to hold stuff against people. We want to see them transformed. And so then Isaiah then goes into one of these hymns that we talked about earlier. And it's a dead giveaway because he says, sing, right? Sing, O ye heavens, for the Lord hath done it. Shout, ye lower parts of the earth. Break forth into singing, ye mountains, O forest and every tree therein. For the Lord hath redeemed Jacob and glorified himself in Israel. And you know, Isaiah was in a vision here because much of his life, there was not much to sing about with regard to Jacob and Israel, right? He saw their sin. He saw their backsliding. He saw their idolatry. He saw the reigns of a whole list of kings who didn't serve God. And even Hezekiah, who basically was considered to be a good king, he saw his failure in his opening up his kingdom to foreigners to show them all his treasures. But here, he's looking ahead to a redeemed Jacob. And he says that God hath glorified himself in Israel. And even though we believe that there will be a time whenever Israel returns to God in a significant way, I think we see these things fulfilled most fully in Jesus. Jesus as the seed of Abraham, as the idealized Jacob in Israel. It is only in him that we can truly see God fully glorifying himself in the earth. Now, it's true that you have to understand that there are limits to the language. For instance, we wouldn't say that Jesus was redeemed, but we would say that God redeemed Jacob in Jesus, right? So that's where the redemption is of the parent of the house of the descent, but it was done in God's redemption through Jesus.
Is there any reason why, at least in my translation, end of 23 says, "For the Lord has redeemed Jacob and will be glorified in Israel." Jacob, Israel.
So we see this this pattern of language. It's
exactly the same thing.
Yeah, perhaps it's the style of Hebrew poetry here. This parallelism where you will repeat something with different words. I know it doesn't rhyme in English, but and didn't rhyme in Hebrew either. But that's a form of Hebrew poetry, and especially through this middle section of Isaiah, we see this over and over again. Thus saith the Lord, thy Redeemer, and he that formed thee from the womb. I am the Lord that maketh all things, that stretcheth forth the heavens alone, that spreadeth abroad the earth by myself. Okay. And so, what's the significance of that emphasis there? I did it alone. I did it by myself.
None of the little gods did it.
Right, so all these other foreign nations have this sometimes elaborate mythology which introduces all sorts of deities. There's the god of this and the god of that and the creator god and the fertility goddess and so on and so forth. And so another key feature, of course, of this section of Isaiah is this dialogue with and against the idolatry of the surrounding world. And God says, I did it alone. There was nobody else involved. I stretched abroad the earth. I stretched forth the heavens. So that's quite a claim, right? And he makes no bones about it. He says that frustrateth the tokens of the liars and maketh diviners mad. That turneth wise men backward and maketh their knowledge foolish. So all these attempts by man to control their future and to control their fellow man as well by their devices, one of which is knowledge. I like this verse a lot. So the tokens of the liars, tokens are like signs. We sometimes in our age are highly isolated from this world, and that is the ancient world. But prophecy, divining, oracles were big business. I mean, big business, right? There was a lot of money involved in being able to convince people that you had an idea what was going to happen. There's all sorts of actions in history, in life, that everything depends on what you do. You know, if you're the leader of a great nation and you're contemplating war on another great nation, if making that decision, you know, it's like, are things okay as they are? Do I risk losing what I have? But then I might gain everything that they have. Wouldn't that be nice, right? But there is this realization from any sane ruler that if this goes badly, I'm toast. It's not going to work out well. What would you pay if you were a very wealthy ruler? What would you pay to know whether this was a good idea or not? A lot. Quite a lot. And Isaiah here says, this is God. He not only spreads out the heavens and the earth, but he frustrateth the tokens of the liars and maketh diviners mad. He does the unexpected. He is in control of things which is beyond their power to predict or to anticipate. And then the wisdom of men. It's an ongoing truth that as history progresses, most of the things that we used to think were absolutely true about our world get disproven, get changed, get modified. Now, one thing that you don't find changing, you don't find changing the truths that have been revealed by God of how to best live life, about how to have meaningful relationships, fulfilling relationships. Those things don't change. You don't have revolutions there. I think of some of the modern trends now where we have attempts to try to change some of the most basic things about our nature. To suggest that, in fact, we haven't been created male and female. And I think of this verse here. He frustrateth the tokens of the liars. He maketh diviners mad and turneth the wise men backward and their knowledge foolish. And it's only, in my mind, a matter of time before these things are so totally flipped on their heads, and people say, you know what, this was the stupidest trend we ever got involved in. This was nonsense. This doesn't work. It can't work.
It reminds me of the Webb telescope that, you know, scientists are saying, I can't sleep at night because this is changing everything I thought about. How the world, the earth came into existence or whatever, just in a moment, It can all be flipped upside down.
Mm-hmm. And we see God here, who says, I am the one by myself. Furthermore, that confirmeth... Yes. Don't know if that was as it sounded, but that was interesting. And my goodness, if you truly perceive God as who he is, then when he comes on the scene, that's what we tend to say, right? If this is the ultimate reality and I've been living in a myth, and he shows up, it's uh-oh. So he continues here in verse 26, that confirmeth the word of his servant and performeth the counsel of his messengers, that saith to Jerusalem, thou shalt be inhabited, and to the cities of Judah you shall be built, and I will raise up the decayed places thereof. And, of course, when Isaiah was writing this, Jerusalem was inhabited. It had not yet been destroyed. They hadn't been taken into captivity yet. So he's looking ahead to the time whenever it is desolate. And he says, God saith to Jerusalem, thou shalt be inhabited. And so we see him here speaking now. It doesn't mention here the way by which he stretched forth the heavens or spread abroad the earth. Of course, Genesis talks about him speaking. But here he saith to the deep, be dry, and I will dry up thy rivers. Okay, and so this is a reflection then on history, what God has done in the past. We have the parting of the Red Sea. We have the Jordan River held back for the people to cross over. So that is history. And verse 28 then looks to the future. That saith of Cyrus, he is my shepherd and shall perform all my pleasure. Even saying to Jerusalem, thou shalt be built into the temple. Thy foundation shall be laid. And let me read just a little bit farther before I comment more about Cyrus. 45 then, thus saith the Lord to his anointed, to Cyrus, whose right hand I have holden, to subdue nations before him. And I will loose the loins of kings, to open before him the two-leaved gates, and the gates shall not be shut. I will go before thee, and make the crooked places straight. I will break in pieces the gates of brass, and cut in sunder the bars of iron. I will give thee the treasures of darkness, and hidden riches of secret places, that thou mayest know that I, the Lord which called thee by thy name, am the God of Israel. Okay, so Cyrus the Great is the one that Isaiah is referencing here, actually predicting here. It's not a look backwards. But I don't know how much you remember from your studies in ancient history, but Cyrus... is a name which is kind of like Pharaoh in Egypt. It's like, you know, Pharaoh? Yeah, which one, right? There were a number of leaders by the name of Cyrus, but Cyrus the Great is the one who was responsible for the restoration of the Jews to their country. In fact, he was a very generous leader with regard to conquering foreign peoples, and he released a lot of people from their captivity, allowed them to return to their homeland. It had been the practice of both the Assyrians and the Babylonians to deport people to other parts of the world in order to control them, and move them out of their homeland, move them to a foreign environment where they had to depend to some extent on the infrastructure that was there and the people that were there. And that really tends to disrupt the kinds of connections that can lead to rebellion when people are in their familiar territory, their own setting. But it resulted in the disintegration of a lot of cultures and nations. And so this is the Cyrus. We talked here a while back about the oracle at Delphi King Croesus of Lydia had consulted about whether or not to go to war. And you remember the oracle said, a great nation will fall or something like that. And so Croesus says, oh, good, here we go. Let's go fight Cyrus. And he was defeated. And sometime later, I don't know if it was his representatives or whoever, went back to Delphi and said, hey, what about this? We gave you a lot of gold for this answer, and we lost. And the answer was, well, a great kingdom fell. It was yours. So that's the way some of those oracles were. They were ambiguous enough that they could go either way. And it was against Cyrus that he was wanting to know whether he should attack or not. Well, Cyrus was incredibly successful in an incredibly short period of time. His empire stretched from the Mediterranean to the Indus River. And he didn't go into Egypt, although his son did. He was the kind of description you see here given of God subduing nations before him, of him gaining the treasures of darkness. So Croesus, for instance, of Lydia, was known for his gold, and that all got sent back to Persia. So what else? He's also the leader who, there are stories about his childhood. His father had received a prophecy that this child would eventually rise up and overthrow him. And so ancient kings were more concerned about their kingdom than they were about their kids in general. And so he paid his servant to get rid of his son. Well, the servant didn't really want to do it. After all, it was a royal heir potentially. And so he abandoned him to a sheep herder. And he was raised then by people who weren't his parents. And it's quite a story about how he ended up becoming the king anyway. So I don't know if you remember that story. I think Herodotus tells that one about how Cyrus came to power. But for our purposes here, it's quite fascinating how Isaiah portrays him here. In verse 1 of 45, he is called his anointed. Well, how does that ring in your ears? That's the Hebrew word for Messiah. So he is a Messiah, in that he was anointed of God. He's not the Messiah that we think of when we think of Jesus. But nevertheless, I think it should help us to remember that sometimes in prophetic language, you have to be careful about being dogmatic, because there is a lot of freedom to when you're talking in these kind of terms. In general here, you'd almost think, if this was all you knew about history, that Cyrus was a Christian. I know that's there's a problem with dates and all there, but you know how we think. He's on our side. He's totally godly. Probably he occasionally worships at the temple once it was rebuilt. No, none of that. He was still a foreign ruler. He still, and in fact, when you talk about him restoring cultures, he was careful to restore the temples of other gods as well. And yet God used him. God brought him to power in order to further the objectives that God had for the eventual redemption of Israel, for the purpose of bringing about the Messiah, God's Messiah, into the world. But I say to myself, and I say to you, since you happen to be listening, that you have to recognize this about prophetic language, that there is this freedom of expression, that you want to be careful to what extent you oversimplify it.
Well, even just the imagery of a shepherd king. So, you know, we see that reflected in Christ as well. So there are patterns of things that then, you know, Cyrus didn't. There were a lot of things about Cyrus that didn't add up to the expected Messiah. But he fulfilled a portion. And so I've even seen the comparison of all the great religious people throughout history. And it's remarkable some of the things, the attributes or things that were attributed to them or things they did. But all the great things you see fulfilled completely in Christ.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you don't get the full picture until you see Christ.
Mm-hmm.
But there are still just glimpses.
Indeed. And keep in mind that fundamentally the term Messiah means anointed one. So there were a lot of anointed ones throughout even Jewish history. The kings were anointed. We remember the time whenever David was anointed by Samuel. It is a symbolic act which designates often a special mission from God. And so there is significance in it, but it doesn't give you a lot of information other than to say this person has a place in God's plan. And then, just to follow through, you've probably heard this many times, we talk about Jesus being the Christ, and sometimes it almost sounds like some people think that's his last name or something. But our word Christ comes from the Greek word, which means anointed. So to say that Jesus Christ is the Messiah is a little bit redundant in one sense, but we've come to know what that means. It sometimes speaks to us anyway. So, like I say, that this kind of creeps up on us here in Isaiah, this prophecy about Cyrus, but this should be flashing lights and in bold, because this is a big deal that Isaiah reveals this in this detail at this time. But then he puts it in perspective. So he says to Cyrus, I will go before thee, I will break down the gates of brass, I will give thee the treasures of darkness. And verse 4, for Jacob, my servant's sake, and Israel, mine elect. So there again, Laura, we have that, Jacob, Israel. I have even called thee by thy name. I have surnamed thee, though thou hast not known me.
Is he still talking to Cyrus?
Yeah. Cyrus, by the way, was not his original name. I am the Lord, and there is none else. There is no God beside me. I girded thee, though thou hast not known me, that they may know from the rising of the sun and from the west that there is none beside me. I am the Lord, and there is none else. I form the light and create darkness. I make peace and create evil. I, the Lord, do all these things. Okay, so that probably made you hiccup there. So in what sense does he mean this? Well, if you're looking for the origin of evil, I wouldn't quote this verse. Where did evil come from? Oh, God created it. That's not the point here. If you look in the world at things that occur, at trouble, at difficulty, we consider all those things to be evil. The point here is that God is in control of all things. So, yeah, we could very easily slip here into various levels of speculation and difficulty. And there are difficult questions in life. And I'm not suggesting that this answers all those. Okay?
Yeah.
We human beings are funny, though. We can't really stay on the topic. We have to take the rabbit trails. So I'm struggling here to see which one I'm going to take. The picture here that Isaiah wants to give us is, and the fact that he wants us to understand, is that the world is not controlled by a host of forces that are separate and different and that we should give honor to and worship and reward with gifts and stuff in order to be sure we're on their good side. That it is God and God alone. It is Yahweh, the God of Israel, that is the ultimate authority. Now, it is true that in his authority, he has allowed in his universe various things to have a degree of freedom. that really is a whole other chapter, right? He has allowed human beings to have a degree of freedom. He gave Jacob the freedom to turn against him. We're not prepared to say that he made Jacob turn against him. Some people might be, but I think that's ludicrous. And a full understanding of the problem of evil, I think, has to center on the understanding that God has permitted it by allowing will outside of his own. It is the fact that we have the potential of doing what we want instead of what is good, which is God's will, that creates evil in the world.
Good is a thing and evil is a thing, and God had to make them separately so that we could choose between them. But maybe this is just semantics, but in my mind, evil is just the twisting of the good. It's taking the good that was created and using it for the wrong reasons, or twisting it in some way. It's the absence of the true good that then turns into evil, but it's not necessarily like a substance that was created.
Right.
So that God was like, okay, now I have to make a bunch of bad stuff so that I can counter it. They have a choice between the two. It's like, no, we just take the really good that he made and use it wrongly.
Same thing with the light. We don't have a problem with God making light, but him making darkness. Well, unless you make everything light, there's going to be something that's not light. So in a sense, he brought that about, even though he didn't specifically say, I'm going to create darkness.
Yes. Well, one of the recurring lines of thought that I think that Isaiah is contrasting with here is the notion that we see in various periods of history of a dualistic universe. So there are forces of light, there are forces of darkness, which are in this eternal conflict that hopefully the good wins out, and here's a way to help it along. And so that's not the picture here we have of God. God created all of it that is, but then he also created the potential within that all of a deviation from himself. And when you do that, there is the possibility of what we see in our world, the absence of good. But if you don't have the possibility of that, then you don't have anything but God.
But then who's creating the evil? I mean, while he gives you the option of deviating from the good, when you choose to do that, you're the one creating the evil. You're the one.
In one sense, but he created the possibility, you know, so the original mover, you're indebted to him for everything.
Right.
So there's no point in serving anybody else. There is nobody else. Like I say, this brings up deep reflections and all that, but I think for Isaiah's purposes, we should be able to recognize that he is pointing out the fact that God is the only God, the only force to be reckoned with in the universe, and that all things can be comprehended in him. And that's a great place to start and a great place to stop. Thank you for your kind attention.